everybody, get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the food and wine variety show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis.
Good morning.
I'm Nikki Nellis with Smoker's Voice.
No, you're not.
I'm not. So today's show is going to be really interesting. It's a whole focus.
It's all Ellen and Todd all the time.
Yeah, actually, Ellen and Todd Gray were among the first guests we had on 10 years ago.
And they were. They were on our very first show.
And they've been our fans ever since. But listen, so according to Exodus 16, as the Israelites are wandering through the wilderness, they need food, right? So the Lord miraculously provides them with the sustenance they need to keep going. It's manna. So appropriately, that was easy for me to say. The name of the signature restaurant in D.C.'s new Museum of the Bible is Manna, and the folks behind it, and Milk and Honey, which is a, can I call it a cafe, sort
coffee
of?
Coffee shop, cafe.
Is our Todd and Ellen Gray, and they're here with us. Todd, as you know, I mean, they're both behind and partners in
Equinox.
Well,
you're taking forever.
No, I'm not. I'm laying it out so that anybody listening will care, so they'll care.
It's taking a long time.
All right. Their award-winning restaurant, Equinox, down in the heart of D.C., and they've
and
taken
their
on...
And gorgeous book, The New Jewish Table.
Ugh, this is marriage in microcosm. Yes, their gorgeous book that they wrote with David Hagedorn, right?
Yes.
Okay, and they're here. They brought in their restaurant, Manna, is the signature restaurant at the museum. They're in. They brought in their chef de cuisine, Walter Silva, and
their pastry chef,
Brandy Edinger, and Susan Masson, who's an archaeologist, and she's the museum curator of antiquities.
And she's a scholar.
God, I'm stepping on it. Too much to drink last night. But first, let's go to Debbie Moser out at Central Farm Markets and find out what's going on there. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, good morning. How are you all?
How are you, Debbie?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm standing out here. It's our last market of the season, the last winter market.
I was going to say, it's not really the last market because it really kicks off next week.
It really does. We open all the summer markets at Bethesda Mosaic next weekend, so we're looking forward to that. And as I was going through the market this morning, I was looking at what's good for Passover and Easter, because they are both next weekend.
I know. So will a lot of
people... Coincidence? I think
so,
not.
So will your markets be open next weekend Easter? Okay, great to know.
They will. Yeah, so that last-minute shopping or your full shopping, if you haven't done it, we're here for you.
if you're doing Easter dinner, we're all here for you. What about specialties that people at your market may be carrying?
Oh, well, we've got... You know what I saw today that I just love using around this time of year? The mushrooms. The hen of the woods, the shiitakes, or the king trumpet. There's a lot of great things you can make for both Easter and Passover with fresh vegetables. We have now fresh tomatoes out. We have fresh basil, garlic, baby green garlic.
So now, is that all, when you say tomatoes and basil, are these things all grown hydroponically? Are they grown under hoops?
They're grown under hoops.
Okay.
Yep, and in greenhouses. And I got to tell you, some of these tomatoes, we've been eating them the last couple of weeks, and I can't get enough in. I'm just craving them.
Because, you know, I feel like given that, I love that you're saying this, because I feel like we in the food world have been sort of like taught, no, you don't eat tomatoes out of season.
Well, because they're not seasonal, right.
Right, because they're not seasonal. But there's this new growing process. It's totally
That's
different,
right.
And you're still
That's
getting
right.
these really tasty, meaty tomatoes, right?
Yeah, they're delicious tomatoes, and the, you know, things like the baby green garlics and the lettuces and the cucumbers.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting them year-round now. But the tomatoes are really starting to come into their own, and we've got heirloom and just beautiful tomatoes. So your salads, even a plate of fresh tomatoes, mozzarella, and basil.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting is that what people need to sort of re-educate themselves on is that it's not – you don't want to eat out of season if it has to travel across the country or across the world.
Correct.
But when it's local, you're really doing good not just for your nutritional sake but also for local farmers as well.
Right. And and in our region, the farmers are – you know, we have so many of them, and they really come out and they're bringing the best. So – We were very happy all winter, all of our patrons that supported them, and we're going to continue on next week as we open the big markets.
Well, that'll be fun. All right, Debbie, let's tell everybody where the markets are.
Okay. The two markets that are running right now are Bethesda, in downtown Bethesda, at Bethesda Elementary, and Mosaic in the Mosaic District. And at the end of April, we'll be talking about Pike and Rose that opens, and then we'll be talking about our new market at Westfield in May that opens.
Very exciting. So, all right, everybody go to Central Farm Markets and get fresh stuff.
And have a happy Passover and happy
you
Easter.
Too.
All right,
you too.
Bye.
Hi, shout out to Ellen and Todd.
Shout out to Ellen and Todd. Okay, they're here. They got shouted out.
Okay.
So,
right.
Ellen and Todd.
Bye-bye.
We are now on Facebook Live, so if you want to reintroduce a little
bit
of what
right.
we're doing here today.
Well, we've got Ellen and Todd Gray in the studio. You know them from Equinox. You know Todd from winning Rammy's Chef of the Year and all that stuff.
And everybody knows Ellen.
And everybody knows Ellen. And if you don't, she's going to make sure you do. But we're now on Facebook Live. We're talking about their signature restaurant, Mana, at the Museum of the Bible. And we're on Facebook Live at Nikki Nellis, NYCCINELLIS. Thanks to Tessa Nellis, who is in from Hollywood, to put us up on stage and screen. All right, so Todd and Ellen, let's start with a little bit of a 411 on you guys, because you didn't just suddenly, you know, like
drop
show up
heaven.
Like on Star Trek. We go,
you weren't like manna coming out of the heavens.
Right. You're manna and womanna, and here you are.
Exodus.
So
beam
a little,
me up,
Exodus 16.5.
I would like to beam up right now. Can we take a break? Why don't we start with you and how you guys got together and your background?
Well, Ellen and I opened Equinox in 1999. We met actually when I was at Galileo back in the mid-90s and food broker.
I heard she spotted you and said, I
want
him.
Gotta have him.
Yeah, he's my man.
I just wanted his business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But
She means that in more ways than one.
Right? Huh? But that led to opening Equinox almost, 19 years in May. And this new project that we're doing at the Museum of the Bible. Just
I have to interrupt.
Awesome.
I remember sitting down with you guys when we were talking about the 10-year anniversary.
I know. What do we do for
Wait a second. Oh, my God. 20 years? That's amazing.
Wait, you're not 26 anymore?
No, I'm not 26 anymore.
That's it for me. Next.
So you created Equinox, but you really had a focus on Equinox to be mid-Atlantic.
Yes.
Specific to the region. But then as you grew and you started, you know, traveling and doing more things and you had a child, you sort of...
A child who's going to college.
Right. But Equinox has always remained true to its roots, but you grew as a chef and you sort of explored other regions and
Strange
other cuisines. Right.
Absolutely. But I think you have to. I think as a chef, you have to evolve. And I think that's a key word is you always are evolving and you're... You don't want to get pigeonholed into just doing one style for decade after decade. And I think that's what I was breaking into. And I found this, you know, when we started exploring more Mediterranean cooking with the book, actually, when we did the development of the book and we started to explore all the influences of our Eastern Russian background and our, you know, melding of these two styles, sort of mid-Atlantic meats.
Well, I just want to say the book is The New Jewish Table and it has been out now for 4 years.
Yes.
4 years? Am I right?
Four years.
Yeah, five years?
Timeless, though.
Is it a chicken and egg thing? I mean, were you interested in all this? And then as it grew,
forced.
You said, we've got enough for a cookbook? Or were you say, let's do a cookbook where nobody's done one? Or?
Well, I think I was more interested in the historical value and the historical knowledge of really food. And I've always been a historical lover of food. And that's how the being based in the Mid-Atlantic sort of really doing our research on the Algonquian Indians and really what was going on in the Chesapeake Bay and what were we eating in this region and really what was the style of cooking that was happening and what are we doing now in this region. And so understanding sort of the history of the food sort of led us to...
But the real roots of the book were a nice Jewish girl with New York Russian
roots. You're
not
roots. That nice.
Not sometimes. Quotes. And Todd, being from Fredericksburg, growing up on Wonder Bread and ham cheese sandwiches, and meeting my family and trying to understand what gefilte fish is.
We know you put mayo on your Wonder Bread. We're not judging. We're just saying.
If
that's
I had
all.
It in front of me, you would love it.
So did you go home after that first night and go, these Jews is crazy? Ugh.
Yeah.
But can we
He does that really well.
Excuse me. Can we digress for 1 minute? what do you think happened with the Algonquian Indians where somebody opened up an oyster and said, well, that looks good.
And the first one to try it.
Right. And it's like drinking mucus. I mean, but it's delicious.
Tasty. A little crunchy, but
yeah.
Tasty.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you don't eat the shell.
Right. Appetizing food show starting.
All right. So Todd.
But no, but so you were, you know, taken in by, you
the
know.
Tribe.
The tribe. And they accepted him. You know, and I think anybody who, listen, whether you marry somebody within your religion or you marry somebody without your religion or race or culture or whatever it is, you know, you have other families' traditions that you either incorporate or do not incorporate within your new family. So you had Ellen's family's traditions, their foods and what they did. And, you know, listen, my grandmother's brisket is dry as a bone, man. I mean, she cooks that thing.
It's like eating a sneaker.
It's like she cooks, you know, everything is dry. Everything. But, you know, as we evolved, while we still take her traditions and put them on our tables, we just
made them better.
I just want to say there might be something to it because she's 96.
Right. But also, some are worth keeping, like this matzo ball soup, which is the recipe of my great aunt Lil. Mm-hmm. And Todd just really added a few tweaks to it. And
he
it pretty
it
much
up.
Stands as it is. I mean, they were the ultimate in cooking with the region and the season, because that's all they had.
Right.
Borscht and Russa is a thing, you know?
Right. There's a reason that they ate
right,
it.
Exactly. But, you know, then he put his culinary know-how on top of very traditional Jewish cultural foods, and then my family accepted him.
Right. I'm sure they accepted you before then. But as you were getting into these recipes, instead of just taking it from a cultural or family background, were you... As you were doing the research on it, did it just open up this whole historical world to you that you were unaware
Absolutely.
Of?
Well, sure. I mean, who, at least I think I speak for a lot of chefs, but I mean, who doesn't want to learn more about food every day? We learn, if you're not learning something new every day, you feel like you're getting flat. And so learning about new cuisines is exciting, and you integrate them and you sort of blend them into your own style.
Well, interesting, because it's really old cuisine. That's new to you.
Absolutely.
Because it goes back thousands of years.
But I think what's really interesting, and we're really going to get into this as we talk about your trip to Israel and sort of your dive into the culinary history there, is how you take this way of people eating and bring it into this century. Because, you know, and we're going to talk to, you know,
Susan
later about what people were eating in, you know, the first century and how different it was.
And you'll try some, too.
Right, exactly. Yeah. All right, you know what? We're going to take the break now, and then when we come back, we'll get into that. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We are talking about culinary eating throughout history with Todd and Ellen Gray and their restaurant. I'm going to say Mana, but is it Mana or Mana? Mana?
Yeah, if you got culture.
Mana from the heavens. Okay, we'll be back in just a sec.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. Nikki and I have repaired our relationship, and we're ready to continue talking to Todd
That's
and Ellen.
Only because I left the room.
Oh, God. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Yahweh. Thank you, everybody, for letting her leave the room. All right, so you guys took you've taken several trips to Israel, but there was this moment when you had an epiphany. What happened there with the food?
Wow. It was changed me as a chef, because to go back and see the biblical influence and to go into Israel and to see
6,000-year-old recipe.
The recipe I did in Jerusalem in the Old City was cooking with a Christian Muslim living in the Muslim quarter, and we're doing a dish, 4,000-year-old recipe with baby lamb and dried goat's milk powder and braising it and going through the whole process. And I don't know, when you do that and you're in the Old City of Jerusalem, I think you feel the history and you just it moves you.
Okay, but how did you wind up there? I mean, how did you wind up with this person and wind up cooking with them? I mean, that doesn't happen to everybody.
Well, the museum set the tour up. The museum set the tour up for us. So we had the help of obviously the museum as well as the Israeli government.
Putting you in touch with the right people.
They set up a tour, a very exact tour of some of the most amazing places and
Well, I mean, Ellen, you lived in Israel, right?
I did, yeah.
You lived in Israel. You lived on a kibbutz. So, I mean, for you to take this kind of tour and see the things that you hadn't seen before, like, what was it?
The country changed so much.
Right, but what was it when you were there from, you know, just an outsider's perspective, looking in, and especially being there from the culinary perspective. Like, what, like, you told me a story about making hummus that I was, I mean, I was like, I want to go so bad just to do that.
It's, yeah, well, the hummus on the second, the this last trip, we made hummus in Akka. It was, you think you've had hummus every way till Sunday, and you've tried them all, and there can't be one that could trump the other, but this one was hands down by far. It blew us all away, and our son was with us too, who was actually the worst food critic of us all, and he loved it. But
he sounds generally like a pain in the ass.
He's an 18-year-old boy.
Right. That's not
and
true.
When I lived in Israel the first time, it was in 1987. It was during the first Intifada. I was living in a kibbutz on the Golan Heights. I was on the border of Syria, and I was working on an avocado. Part of the kibbutz was avocado farming, and I was actually working with the animals.
So you were eating avocado toast before everybody
else was. Eating avocado toast and starting in 1987, and it really was. It was a lot of the South Africans came over and taught us about avocado toast. But and then I actually moved down to work on a scuba diving boat in the Red Sea, and I was cooking fritters, which are now risotto fritters on the menu, on a boat, and we would sail into Sharm el-Sheikh and up the Sinai. So you could see, I could see back then in the 80s, where Israel was going with their farming technique and having to, you know, basically farm in a desert, and the technology that they were starting to really put into the country, and their culinary scene was, you know, very farm oriented back then. And then what it is today, flash forward, is incredible. It's one of the best culinary tours I've ever taken.
Clear something up for me, because when I was there in 1971, I was there way back
right around statehood.
And when we would stop, not statehood.
Well, okay.
Good Lord.
That was 70 years ago. Okay, sorry.
Damn, I'm not that old. But anyways.
Well, actually, he is that old because he was born when statehood.
Right.
When they got statehood.
I dated Golda Meir.
I thought you said you were there in 1951.
Everybody's trying to parse on
TV, she was hot. Particularly with her, you know. Anyway. But I remember they used to have, no, her gun. Not her.
Oh, okay.
But anyway. You're killing me. There were roadside stands and you would get tahini and all of that, but there was a ton of steak. Like, where was the steak coming from then? Because there were not, all the farms
it was
I
goat,
saw
were. David.
No, it wasn't goat.
It was probably goat.
They told Americans it was steak.
Is that it? No, my cousin was serious. No, I mean, where did all the meat come from? Because there was steak, and were they importing it?
Or
because
lamb. It would either be lamb or goat, right?
Well, they were starting to really farm, you know, as soon as they.
Because everything I saw was watermelons or avocados.
It was,
or,
maybe,
you know,
from a kibbutz, the farming. I mean, that was predominantly what a lot of Israel was kibbutz right after statehood in the 40s.
Well,
our kibbutz was started by.
Come up to the mic. Go ahead, Alan. Finish up.
Survivors from Germany.
Right.
And, you know, I met them. I was lucky enough to meet them, and they were just starting farming everything from cattle to avocados.
So.
Well, Susan, I want to bring you up. You.
Let's reintroduce Susan. Susan Maston, who is the museum's curator of antiquity. She's an archaeologist.
And a scholar. I just like saying that because that's something I'm never going to be.
And wait a minute, and she's smart. So,
so as an archaeologist, mm-hmm. and you work at the museum, and you helped put together the table. Explain the table.
Yeah, so one of our exhibits in the museum is called The World of Jesus of Nazareth, and it's a reconstruction of a first century Jewish village. So one of the things you can see in the village is a typical house of that time. And so if you go in the house, we have a table all set out with food they would have typically eaten at the time. We also have a cooking courtyard, so you can go and see what their oven would have looked like, very different from ours, and just
and
some of the food they
able,
had.
Like, what is the research for that? Like, how do we know? It was so long ago. It's not like we have photos mm-hmm. or videos.
I was
or
a waiter at the Last Supper, but I've forgotten everything I served. So
there's a few different ways. Obviously, the Bible talks about food, but it doesn't really talk specifically about how they made food. Like, there's no recipes in the Bible for the most part. We do have some recipes that have survived from the Romans, from that time period. And then also through excavation. So if you go up two floors in the museum, we have an exhibit from the Israel Antiquity Authority, so the main archaeological body in Israel. And they actually have an oven, it's called a tabun, that they excavated from a site, and they've brought that. They also have cooking pots and grinding stones, and they actually have organic material, so date pits, olive pits, a garlic clove, all that date to the first century. So that kind of thing is very rare.
It's so amazing.
Yeah.
So as you were setting this table, what in the first century, mm-hmm. what was gracing the tables? What were people eating?
So there obviously were different economic classes at the time. So your
different than today.
Yes. So your average villager living in Israel would have had a very simple diet, mostly bread made up probably 50% of their diet, and basic things they could grow, olives, goat milk and cheese you can make from goat milk and things like that. The more elite, the Roman elite would have ate much, much richer, fancier diet. The Romans, especially at that time, had a very exotic and luxurious diet. So today...
Because they were bringing things in from other mm-hmm. regions, because it wasn't just from that region.
No, yeah. So today we think it's really cool for everything to be locally sourced, mm-hmm. and that's very important to us. The Romans had the opposite attitude. The more exotic and far away it was, the better, because mm-hmm. that was one of the advantages of living in the Roman Empire, was you had access to, you know, if you lived in Italy, you could get things from North Africa, from Asia, from all over the world. So,
but was the integration of, I mean, did that trickle down? So like spices and things of that nature, if the elite had it, mm-hmm. did it initially trickle down because the people who worked on it took some with them and brought it home? I mean, did some of those things integrate into different socioeconomic levels?
Yeah, it would have a little. Again, the average, your average Joe villager, for most of the time, they ate kind of the same thing. But on special occasions during feasts and festivals, weddings, you have stories of weddings in the New Testament, they would have had more a fancier spread then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, is there any information? I mean, have you guys figured out when kosher started being a thing? Because kosher, we were talking before the show, mm-hmm. keeping kosher set the Jews apart and mm-hmm. probably made them for everybody else. Like, oh, those weird Jews, they won't eat. You know, when did pigs start becoming part of the diet?
Well, the Muslims
and all of that.
Don't eat pigs either.
Right, yeah. But I mean, my point is, when did that start happening in Palestine?
So not eating pig goes back basically to the beginning. One of the ways they differentiate Israelite sites from, say, the Philistine sites is the presence of pig bones.
Oh,
so,
those Philistines.
Yeah, those Philistines, they
deserve
pig.
The bad rap they get. Don't they, Todd? No Philistines.
Yeah, but at an Israelite site... if you're up in the hill country or something, you'll find very few pig bones, and that's one of the ways they identify the sites.
Was it because pigs were, you know, you could get trichinosis? I mean, they were dirty animals. Is that why?
I mean, they had no concept of germs and that kind
right.
of thing back
but, I mean,
then.
Right. It's not like they
no, but they could associate if you eat pig, you're going to get sick. Versus, no, we don't know.
We don't know.
I wish I remembered more from the last. Too busy getting autographs.
Well, so Ellen and Todd, as you guys were crafting your menu, you went on this trip to Israel and you got to have all these experiences. And were you trying to take things from old to make it new? Like, what were you looking to do with the restaurant initially? And I think we should explain to people first what the restaurant is like, because it's the only, you have the cafe, Milk and Honey, which is fabulous. But like, you have a restaurant at the top of the museum. It's a beautiful space, but you are feeding almost everybody who walks into the museum, which is insane, given how many visitors are coming in every day. No, I mean, I've been there when it's in action. It's right. insane. So can we talk about your concept, what Manna is supposed to be?
Well, I'll share this
Take
time.
It,
well, I think when we went over to Israel, we were going on this last trip for authenticity, mm-hmm. to understand also what modern Israeli cuisine is, as well as, you know, super old things that Susan's referencing.
Why do you look at me when you say that?
And I think that, like most restaurants, you start in one place and you evolve, because you can't just open saying, okay, this is it, this is everything. And with the help of our culinary team, who are here and you'll hear from later, mm-hmm. we're continuing to evolve the taste and flavor there. So the menu is not, this is it, this is what we've opened with.
Right.
But through more research, hopefully a trip that we'll all take back over there.
When you say you all.
We'll continue.
You looked over there. Why don't you look over here?
Yeah, because our culinary team is here with us today.
And he's over there, too, you know.
Right.
And he's like, I'll go on a trip.
He is an honorary Jew.
You know, it's all about the team. And, you know, with the help of this team, we're continuing to evolve that menu. But we started in one place, and we're going to keep going and going deeper and more authentic, and perhaps creating some new things with our own ingredients here. And yeah, we're not stopping. We're just getting started. Yeah, we're only 4 months old.
We should go with you and do and record shows from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Let's
that
do
would
it.
Be...
We're already talking about
and
it.
I'm changing my last name to Gray.
Yeah, okay. All right, you know, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I mean, you have all these dishes in studio. We want to talk
I've
about them.
Eating.
I know, David.
These are delicious.
Already in. I mean, that's no joke to anybody who listens to the show regularly. We're going to talk about the dishes, how they are formulated, and sort of some of the history of some of them. And Todd, I want to talk more about your experiences in Israel and how you took those experiences and put them on the plate. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We're going to Israel. We'll be back in just a sec.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. Before we get back to the show, I just want to thank our sponsors, ProFish, the mm-hmm. market at River Falls, it's a fabulous specialty market in Potomac. And if you're planning your Easter feast or your Passover feast and you need catering, they do it, man. Mm-hmm. They do it.
Sometimes a little supplement is all you need.
Yeah.
Well, since you do the table, I mean, seriously, I know you know how much help is necessary.
You know,
you don't make the Seder. I make the Seder.
Are there any marriage counselors listening? Please call in. All right. So let's get back to you guys.
Todd and Ellen Gray.
Yes. Todd. Well, I hope that people have been listening. Todd and Ellen Gray, mm-hmm. who opened up a signature restaurant at the Museum of the Bible called mm-hmm. Mana, and they brought in great foods and great help and great folks. We just heard from Susan Mastin. You want to introduce your support team?
Absolutely,
here?
Absolutely. So we have Walter Silva, our chef.
Walter and Brandy.
Walter Silva, our chef de cuisine from the museum, and really helps run all of the food service with us. And Brandy Ettinger, our executive pastry chef, who just is doing brilliant things. I think you'll get a chance to taste them and speak for you.
Right. Yeah. Well, so Brandy and Walter, I'd love to hear how you worked with Todd to come up with the items that you wanted to put on the menu for Mana.
Mana. Mana makes you sound cultured, but it's Mana.
Mana from the heavens.
Oh, my aunt says.
Okay. So, you know, were there things both from your own backgrounds that you were like, yes, I understand this, and I believe that this is a part of the historical importance of what we're doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think where I come from, I'm originally from Peru, so it's like the other side of the world. It's not
really next door to Israel, right?
You know, you know, but I do understand cooking, you know, like out of necessity and, you know, with sustainable ingredients and what's available and, you know, and just make it happen. So, you know, like working with fresh ingredients and all this is, you know, like something I'm familiar with. But at the same time, you know, like under, you know, like hard conditions because, you know, busy places, you know, like trying to put out the best food we can. And then under Chef Todd's direction, you know, we try to kind of like channel all these, you know, like flavors and ideas in order to make it approachable. Mm-hmm. So in this case, what we put together, you know, is actually something I was trying to recreate, almost like the flavors that you will find in that time. You know, they would talk about, you know, like, for example, like this chicken galantine that it was like cooked in a, they didn't have access to salt, something that for anybody would be super easy to get. In this case, they use a fermented fish sauce. You know, it's kind of weird, but, you know, like.
So wait a second. They used in, so.
For this dish, that chicken galantine that
so there was
today.
No salt?
I mean, you know, it was like hard to access to, like, you know, like stuff like, for example, like, well, from what I read, and mm-hmm. it was hard to access, you know, like,
yeah,
to, you know,
was there no
yeah,
salt?
Because the Romans were always
he
sending,
was there, he
know,
would know
the Romans, the Romans. But, why did you look at me again? The Romans were always sending people you know, to the salt mines in yeah, the movies.
For example, but yeah, you know, it's like, for example, you know, it's not like you can just have it on your like dispensary, you know, like you get access to like. Salty cheeses or like fish sauces, or you need mm-hmm. to like ferment things. So that's how they develop flavors. You know, it wasn't as Chef Brandy will tell you, like when she tries to work and they don't have sugar, for example, you know. And but then when it comes to savory, you know, they didn't have so many ingredients, so they will replace it with another stuff. So they'll make it stronger or kind of like, you know, kind of like brighten up some more flavors. In this case, we did a Roman pesto. There is the original pesto, not like the creamy pesto that you'll find anywhere else.
With cheese.
Here is more like a rustic, you know, rustic, almost like, you know, like roughly chopped mint and some basil and parsley, you know, put a little bit of pecorino romano, you know, like chunks mm-hmm. in there. some, you know, like, but then, you know, like, we make it nice, so we put a little bit of a chive oil, but obviously nobody would bother in that time to make any.
You know, Walter, I think we should taste that.
Yes, my husband is like, why is that over there and not over
come
here?
Come on, Taddy, send it over.
Okay. Well, so Brandy, come up to the mic. So Walter really brought up some really interesting facts. I mean, we're so used to things being at the ready for us. You know, salt, I mean, salt aplenty. There's 18,000 kinds of salt, gray salt, black salt. I mean, you know, we just think that salt was always ready, or sugar, which also we all have, are so accustomed to just having access to. So as you were coming up with your recipes, I mean, you brought in some beautiful things today. Did you say, okay, I can't use sugar? Or how did you decide to go, how did you go about making things authentic, but still being able to go to the palates of today?
Actually, through reading the book and just doing some research on this.
Wait, okay, which book are we talking about?
Around the Roman Table.
Around the Roman Table.
Yeah. I actually did learn that
it's Susan's book.
That butter and sugar was something that they really did not frequently have. Honey was something that they used all the time, which is why both of these desserts here have either a honey glaze or honey as a sweetener. But yeah, I actually read, as far as the salt goes, that, you know, yes, they didn't have it around a lot like we do now, but they said when they wrote the recipes back then that they just assumed that people knew to put salt in. So they left it out of the recipe.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I learned a lot reading these books, truthfully.
So how did you decide to, like, let's talk about some of the things you brought in today and what's on the menu.
Let's talk about the bomboloni.
The bomboloni. This is a lemon ricotta fried dough. The name, actually, as far as ancient Roman times, is globi, which means globe or sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, these were made with wheat flour, ricotta, egg, and just honey glazed. Mm-hmm. I did half and half, like wheat and all purpose, just because I didn't want it to be so dense. And they're soaked in a orange blossom honey. I add a little bit of orange blossom just because otherwise there's not a lot of flavor, and there's lemon zest.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying that.
Oil? I mean, was oil?
They used lard.
Okay, so
yes.
Animal fat. So exactly. They used everything.
Yep. Exactly.
Okay.
The torte, this is actually a pepper and nut torte. So there is a little bit of fresh cracked black pepper in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's gluten-free. It is very dense, obviously, because they did not have leaveners back then. So no baking powder or anything like that. It just relied.
So matzo was flat because matzo was flat.
No, but wait a minute.
They had to run.
I thought when my people were let go, that part of the reason they had matzo was because it didn't sit around
but
to leaven the bread.
And then there's yeast.
Right.
So you don't put yeast in a cake.
No, baking powder, baking soda.
Baking powder, baking soda, right.
Correct. So this has neither. This is literally just egg, pine nuts. Pine nuts and hazelnuts, obviously a very big Roman Italian staple.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also drizzled with honey as well to add a little bit of sweetener, because otherwise there's no sweetener whatsoever. So it is a very dense cake, but, you know, even in Italy today, everything is, they do all these nut torts and they're very dense, and that's why.
Susan, do you mind coming up to the mic for a second? Because the talking about salt and sugar, sort of things that, you know, I just think people of today think everybody had access to all the time. I mean, we're just sort of flush and that kind of stuff. What did people use? Or was flavor not important and it was just about nourishment and sustenance?
So for the Romans, flavor was important.
Didn't they have vomitariums? Is that real?
Vomitariums. Yeah.
I mean, Dionysus, very elaborate feasts and things they would have around that cult.
Awesome.
But yeah.
That's the ancient. No, that's
sounds like
now
bulimia.
We call it party till you puke.
It's an eating disorder.
Right. Yeah, but so the Romans had a very different palate from us. They used a lot of spices, probably more than what.
From the West Indies, like from like Asia, where were they getting all of these?
Asia, Africa.
Okay.
Maybe Europe, but yeah, so very, a lot of spices. But I mean, you mentioned from Peru, so you have to think about the Romans were pre-Columbian, so they didn't have, you were talking about avocados earlier, that's a new world.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a fruit or vegetable?
Yes.
I don't know. So they didn't have that back then. They didn't have tomatoes. They didn't have corn. They didn't have potatoes. They didn't have vanilla and chocolate. So these are all things that we're so used to today that they had no idea about.
Right. But they had dates.
Mm-hmm. Dates. Olives. You mentioned honey. Olive was one of the major, it still is today, one of the major products of the Mediterranean.
So would a Roman have, I mean, had a version of what Walter prepared here?
Yes.
Okay. And did they, I mean, I don't know, did they have chickens?
Oh, yeah.
They had chickens. All right.
Oh, yeah. Turkeys, no, but chicken,
this,
yes.
The flavor of this, without all the modern stuff, is, and first of all, the chicken is unbelievably tender.
And that was authentic to this recipe.
It's delicious. I mean, it really is. And the pesto, the way you handle the pesto. Nice. So this, a Roman general, whatever, would have, or a Roman governor, would have had a meal similar to this.
Walter's not done yet. He's got something else up his sleeve here. Walter, what's the other dish you brought in?
That's where you make it up your sleeve?
This is so gorgeous. Look at this dish.
Another one of my tricks. This is a cheese salad. Basically, we took some halloumi that we're currently using at Mana. Mm-hmm. And our grilled cheese and the coffee shop coming every day. the only thing that I changed about the original recipe, like I charred the cheese to develop some of the nuttiness on the halloumi. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for the people that doesn't know, it's like goat cheese and sheep's milk, you know, that again, you know, it's like another like salty cheese that, you know, like you don't really need to, like,
you don't need to
much
that,
to it, you
right.
know? So this has like a little bit of vinegar, some preserved celery, and fresh, you know, like parsley leaves, celery leaves, and some, yes, a little bit of, crushed pepper on top.
Okay, mm-hmm. But for people to understand the restaurant, mm-hmm. it's sort of a fast, casual restaurant. Mm-hmm. So is this salad on the menu?
Well, you know, this is a great thing about the collaboration we have at the museum with, like, Walter and Brandy and all of us. We always take
it could be on the menu tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, we're always looking for new flavors and new things as we develop sort of these, again, a great sort of historical dish. How do you make it and how do you keep it consistent to serve 500 portions a day? And that's the trick. And that's what I was saying to Danielle before, was keeping things in kind of volume. But this can certainly probably make it on. We were talking about spring dishes. It's got great greens, it's got fresh herbs.
We also started doing specials recently to sort of test these kinds of mm-hmm. dishes because the menu is pretty set. It's kind of hard to change that menu, you know, so quickly. But it's much easier for them to put up a special every day.
Sure.
So they've been doing a lot of different research, and we call it on the menu, like, Brandy's seasonal dessert. Then we're not committed to any one thing, and Brandy gets to try out a lot of different things, ring it in as,
okay,
Brandy's seasonal dessert.
People,
same with Walter, that
really
he
addressed.
Does a special
so
every
people
day.
Who haven't been in, what is on the menu? Like, when somebody comes in, because you're not just catering to people who are interested in a historical meal necessarily, or somebody
when people
who,
are kind of surprised at.
Right, or people who, you know, are just coming in for a Todd Gray meal. You're catering to people, you're catering to tourists.
Well, and we did realize early on that there's definitely people who are down for trying, halloumi or tahini for the first time. Then there's also, we learned that there's definitely people who would like a fried chicken French fry thing. So we added that to the menu. We didn't exactly open with the basket, but, you know, we do listen to the customers coming
kids,
through.
Like,
yeah,
having,
and
like,
a lot of,
and, like, sure. you know.
People tell you what they think, and we as hospitality-driven minded people. So we did add that to the menu. No, you're not going to find that in biblical times, but it makes
Moses
people very
burner.
Happy. So,
well, but too, it's true.
But at the same time, you'll find falafel,
you know,
and
you're going to do chicken strips and little crispy potatoes, integrating za'atar and doing brining with
it's
yogurt
true.
And Israeli spices,
za'atar.
So that when you do taste it, it's not just what you might
okay,
anticipate.
For people who don't know what za'atar is, can you explain that? Because I've had your mixture and it's delicious.
Za'atar actually is traditionally made with hyssop, which is a strand of oregano,
mm-hmm.
and it is a blend of oregano or hyssop, sesame, and sumac.
Okay, and it's just ground together.
Kind of
ground
a spice
together,
blend.
Exactly.
And it's literally like sprinkled
so
on.
So when it hits something hot, it's very aromatic. You get the toasty nuttiness, you get this little fruitiness from the sumac, and you get that real deep herbaceousness from
And that's one of those things that when we went to Israel, like, you know, first time we saw it, we used it sort of daintily because we didn't really get it. And then we went to Israel and
they just throw it on.
Fistfuls. Yeah. Like, oh, it's like, oh, that's how you use it. And mm-hmm. it just changes everything. So you have to use the right amount of a za'atar.
It's
for
like
sure.
the old bay in Maryland.
Yes.
Exactly. But that's I think is some of the key flavor profiles in this type of food is the spices and understanding how smoking cinnamon and how you really are curing lemons. Well, we've done preserved lemons forever, but curing them with Aleppo pepper and lemon juice and olive oil for a short period of time so it's still very acidic, and you integrate that into the dish, and you sometimes you eat it and you go, what is that flavor?
Right.
But this, when we went there, we got to work with all the chefs, and they were showing me all these different techniques for really making the food explode.
Well, wait, we have to take a break.
Well, I just want to say, you really can't – oh, my God. Don't condescend to me on the air. Wait till we're off the air. No, but, I mean, you really can't get this kind of meal anywhere else in Washington. You got to go to Mana to get these taste – profile.
Yes, she's like,
thankfully.
Yes, you can. Yeah. Well, wait, yeah. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about everybody here in studio about when people come and eat here, whether it's at Milk and Honey or at Mana, getting that, understanding what you're eating, because you have to educate people as they're sitting down. And now not everybody wants to get an education when they sit down, but they should.
But they're
case.
Also at a museum, so right. You know they're curious to begin
right.
with.
All right. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Feeding the Beast. Right? We'll be back in just a sec.
All right, we're back on Fooding the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. Before we get back to the show again, I want to thank our sponsors, ProFish, the finest sustainable fish anywhere, period. Not gefilte fish, because you can't fish for gefilte fish, right? Okay. Market at River Falls, which has everything you want for Easter dinner, for Passover, you name it, they've got it. Mm-hmm. And our friends at Meat Crafters, Skinny Salamis, and Central Farm Markets, great sponsors. For a great show, let's be honest. Come on, everybody nod your head out there in the audience.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's get back to where we're – oh, we want to talk about – we have actual manna here.
Tess, can you get in on that?
I don't know if it dropped from the heavens. Did it? Is it possible?
Well,
Ellen?
In the day.
In the day?
Appropriate for Passover. The story goes –
we're going to taste it and see what it – what you can see it.
The Jews were fleeing. They were hungry and – God tested them and their strength to survive.
Do you think that's where our cultural hunger comes from? Because everything's so
God testing us?
Yeah, no, no.
Yes.
About
God tests us every day.
Just being hungry.
No, no, no. Why we always want to bring food with us, because we never know when we're going to be without.
Right. Well, that is a very it's a very true sort of anyway, there's a whole other story about that and why we haven't caught up to our instincts of hoarding food.
I always bring food on the road. What if I get lost?
Right, right.
I may need to eat.
Car
so this fell dashboard dining. This fell from the heaven. Some say that it could have been the bees in a dust storm, and it swirled up.
I mean, it tastes like honey. Taste it.
It does.
Did you try it?
It's,
yeah, it tastes like honey.
What
and
is
so this
it exactly?
is actual. This is actual manna, which is from a province in the Middle East that was brought in for us by a spice trader, Baruch. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Baruch. It is, I'll say insect larva. That doesn't sound very tasty, but it's a crystallized honey. I keep looking at Susan because I know she doesn't.
But wait, it tastes and looks like bee pollen.
Right.
Like crystallized bee pollen.
It tastes and looks like raisin bran, actually.
It's more the ancient version of that. And there is a small village that is still cultivating this.
Cultivating it. Fascinating.
And there's a few chefs that use it.
Well, it's, you know, it's almost like, you know,
you don't use it too much because you can't get it that often. So we sort of hoard this bag
here in the United States, but we're fortunate enough to get some. But it's more of a finishing type of, it's like a sweet finishing crystal, mm-hmm. like you would use finishing salt. It's, you know, sprinkling it on desserts. Actually, one of the great flavors I think we've found.
I'll try it.
You make cardamom ice cream. And you sprinkle manna on the top and then drizzle it with espresso. It's like a Middle Eastern
delicious.
Avocado.
Maybe we'll start
it's outrageous.
Right. A manna farm.
But it's a little of that crunch crystal is that sweet crystal in the finish. That's what we use it for.
Okay. Yeah. So when we were off air, we were talking about so many different things. Brandy, when you're doing the desserts for this concept, I mean, since people are in the museum, they're not looking for a long sit down. What are the kinds of things that you're producing there that people can get, you know, something sweet to finish?
I think exactly what Todd said really is that, you know, constantly have to recreate and change things according to what people like. Because initially we went into this trying to stay true to, you know, to let's do Israeli desserts, let's do, you know, hamantaschen and things like that. But, you know, I kind of learned over time that people are going to buy what they know. And while mm-hmm. you have some people that are here that, you know, they're interested in trying things that they never have, the majority of people, they look for something that they can relate to. So, you know, like the soufganiyo we have there, we have on the menu. We fry them fresh every day for the restaurant in Mana.
Do you just put in quotes donuts. Like fried donuts?
No, we haven't done
that. We actually have not, but
people are getting it.
Yeah, they can at least identify, you know, that's a donut.
Right.
But you do have a lot of people asking, so, and I'm always happy to explain it to them because, you know, myself, I love to learn about new things.
But there's definitely a portion of people who – there's a large portion that does like to see familiar foods. But
sure.
There's definitely – you know, we get stopped every day walking through the restaurant or wherever we're on our way to, and people will pull us aside and say, I've never had anything like this before. This is amazing. And they're experiencing something new, and they're a little more adventurous, and they are trying something new, like tahini and grits together. I mean, that's a sort
that's
of a little
Virginia thing.
A Virginia meets Israel kind of thing, or the Middle East kind of thing. But we are definitely turning some palates around a little bit, too, I think. So we're always striking a balance between keeping people happy who just want to stay with the chicken fried basket.
How are you educating? So is there, when you look at that menu, do you have like little blurbs on everything?
We had to put pictures. Okay. In the beginning, it was a written menu. And then I realized that, well, it took longer to get through the line because people just didn't understand. And, you know, we're so used to working with it. We didn't even think for a minute that people wouldn't understand what a falafel was. But we have people coming from all over the place that just, they don't know what a falafel is. And I'm so grateful that we have the opportunity to introduce them to one, but they really needed to understand it better. So we took pictures of all the dishes and put it on a big poster and then put it on the menu. And things move a lot more smoothly now because everybody can see what the dish looks like before they get it. So that's made things a lot easier.
I want to get Susan back over to the microphone, and I'm sorry to hear you feel awful.
That is Susan, all he's wanted to say throughout the entire show.
That isn't true because I could have said it anytime I wanted. Okay. So, Susan, you're an archaeologist and you've studied all this. Is there anything that just sort of blew your mind when you found out that ancient people ate such and such? Like, where did they get it? How did they do it?
I mean, we were talking about the za'atar earlier. Like, that we do date back to the Roman period. So that's really cool that that's something that has been eaten for over 2,000 years and has just kind of continued on. The Romans ate a lot of weird stuff we would not eat today.
Well, they were big offal eaters, right? Didn't they eat heart and kidney? Guts. They ate organs,
udders, bladders, tongues, ears, eyes.
They were real utilizers of nose to tail.
They're real snap to tail.
More noses, please.
They didn't waste anything.
Yeah, no, they ate everything. They also. The other thing I thought was interesting that I didn't know before was today we like kind of honesty in food and things to be what they are. The Romans thought it was hilarious if you could trick someone into eating something.
Trump lie.
So there's this story of a cook feeding someone anchovies, but they were actually
a vegetable
that they disguise as an anchovy.
Well, it's Trump Loy.
I mean, that's what Michel Richard was famous for. You know, he would serve you something and it would look like a hard-boiled egg, but it was really mozzarella and tomato.
So they thought it was hilarious when you were able to successfully pull that off for somebody.
Isn't that amazing? We're talking about dining 2,000 years ago, and I think we all... Well, not everybody. I can't speak for everybody here, but you believe that like primitive culture just didn't have the savvy to either dine that way or have the access. And yet some people, the wealthy people, did, it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
What was available?
Yeah. The cookbook that we've been talking about, Around the Roman Table, is based off a cookbook that survived from the 4th century AD that's based or comes from a cook or a man named Apicius who lived during the 1st century. And there's kind of a legend around him that he was a huge foodie to the point that later in his life, he realized he was running out of money and he wouldn't be able to maintain his lavish food lifestyle. And he killed himself.
No Michelin stars in that.
No Michelin stars at all.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, after he did eventually die from whatever cause, his name became synonymous with a chef, like a head chef.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Brandy, I have a quick question. You said this cake that you made has no flour in it?
No.
Is this a Passover friendly?
Yes.
Are you guys going to make matzah?
This will be on the menu.
Are you making matzah?
No, we're buying matzah from Brooklyn. Thank you.
Okay. Nobody makes matzah down here.
Cake, however, will be on the menu this week. We just decided that.
Yeah, it's almond flour, ground pine nuts. I mean, that's it.
It's
beautiful.
Right.
A little bit of hazelnuts in there.
We got to wrap it up,
Susan, for this cake.
The show is almost over. We got about a half a minute. Todd, now tell everybody where MANA is and what the hours are and all the basic stuff.
We're at inside the Museum of the Bible at 400 D Street Southwest.
Why does she get so quiet
when
she's
on the sixth floor?
She's very proper.
I don't want to be
too loud.
Too loud. Right. We're on the sixth floor. And
okay, can we talk quickly? You're going to be doing brunch. Brunch is rolling out in April. Can we talk about it? You got it. 30 seconds.
Yeah. Hip hop.
Gospel hip hop
brunch at the Museum
DJ
of the Bible.
Second A-Rock. Saturday,
second Sunday of the month, each month, and sort of a little Mediterranean, Southern, a lot of fun. DJ's happening.
Excellent. And you're going to be doing culinary dinners as well, educational yes. culinary dinners,
yes.
right?
It'll featuring be like Susan. Dinner and a movie, but with Susan.
Excellent. All right. Well, we can't wait for you guys to tell us more about it. We thank you both so much, all of
you,
for coming in today. This was so interesting. And as we gear up for both Passover and Easter, there are tons of fabulous recipes that you can look at in Todd and Ellen's book, Tessa. Pull in tight on that, please, for both your Passover or Easter table. But, of course, you can go to the Museum of the Bible and check out what Todd and Ellen are doing there at MANA. We want to thank you all for joining us today. And everybody, please have a delicious week.